This morning's reading is from a book by Joan Chittister, Sister Joan Chittister, Catholic nun, who's written a really interesting and fun book. I think it's a fun book to read, called Welcome to the Wisdom of the World. I read once from it before. She's got a chapter in each chapter of the book. She's addressing a particular spiritual question, and she's looking at some of those questions from each of the major world religions. So this morning I'm looking at her attempt to answer from a Buddhist perspective the question, would I do it all again? Now, it may not seem on the surface that this might be directly applicable to our topic this morning of love, but love being such an integral element of life more broadly, I think that you may be able to hear and sense resonances in this reading. Chittister tells a story of a young Buddhist student, young Buddhist monk, trying to answer his master's koan, which is sort of a Buddhist puzzling saying, and one of the ones most often quoted is actually the one in this story, which is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? The student goes off and tries to figure out what the sound of one hand clapping is. He comes back with the sound of dripping water, the sound of the wind, and each of these is turned away as incorrect. Finally, the student comes back to the master and says, I can collect no more sounds. I have reached nothing but soundless sound. To which his teacher replies, that he has now reached true meditation. Here's what Chittister extrapolates from this story. Like Toyo, the student, we all start young, so eager, so sure of ourselves. Life, we think, is simply a series of tasks to perform, a list of things to do. Get the job, buy the house, finish the degree, have the children, do the work. It takes years to figure out, if we ever do, that life is not a task at all. Life is far more difficult than that. Life is a process of coming to see what is not seeable, to hear what is not said, to become what we are but never knew we were. Then one day we give up reaching for the unreachable. We quit struggling to hold on to what was not ours to own. We quit crying about what we didn't do, what we didn't know, what we never got. Then we begin to understand that life is more than its failures, more than its trophies. Life, it became clear, has something to do with accepting its impermanence, learning to move on in both mind and body, accepting who we are, and forgiving ourselves for who we are not. Then we began to be happy. I think you can sense in that reading that there are several moments when you could simply substitute the word love for the word life. Love, we think, is simply a series of tasks to perform. No. It takes years to figure out if we ever do that love is not a task at all. Love is a process of coming to see what is not seeable, to hear what is not said, to become what we are but never knew we were. That's my favorite line. To become what we are but never knew we were. Huh? Then one day we give up reaching for the unreachable. We quit struggling to hold on to what was not ours to own. Sound familiar for any of those relationships gone by, struggling to hold on to what was not ours to own? We quit crying about what we didn't do, what we didn't know, what we never got. Love, in a way, in Chittister's story, in Chittister's account of this story, she's saying, life is a lesson in letting go. Buddhism, she says, tells us we have to figure out that so much of life is impermanent. We don't get to make things stay. We don't get to make people stay. We don't even get to make love stay. When we began this sermon series on February 5th, I said that love is one of those qualities of being human that we seem to talk about an awful lot, but struggle to fully understand. On the one hand, it seems to me it couldn't be simpler, really, right? Love is our human capacity to care for one another. What's so hard about that? But as you and I all know well enough, we have a hard enough time doing that very well. We're not always particularly good at caring for one another. The other challenge, I think, though, is the fact that our definition of love ends right there, that it's just about caring for one another, usually seen through a romantic lens. It's romantic or intimate love that so many songs and novels and movies point us toward. We're offered an idyllic vision of finding Mr. or Ms. Right and living happily ever after. The problem with this vision is that it doesn't always work out that way. In fact, it rarely works out that way, and our love lives are not that simple. Perhaps we wouldn't even want them to be. After the initial excitement and first blush of love is gone, we have to settle in and settle down. We have to love, as one reading that I love says, we have to love even when we don't. We have to hold fast to our care and love for someone in spite of the things they do that might disillusion or disappoint us. The mainstream vision of romantic love is in some ways a trap, my friends. We are destined to be let down, that we don't have what is lifted up to us as this idyllic, wonderful goal that we should all aspire to. And we are also equally upset when we discover that in spite of having found this magical, magnificent kind of love, that it isn't as effortless or as perfect as we were led to believe it would be. So I guess I'm saying it's actually a double trap. Either you don't find love and you're pissed off and you're ticked that you don't got this thing that all these other people apparently have. How come I don't have it? Or you have it and you think, well, this isn't so great and rosy and wonderful all the time. It's work. You're still here? Now, as upsetting to me as the number of people left devastated and feeling inadequate by the lack of perfect romantic love in their lives, and that does drive me bonkers. How many people cowered at home during Valentine's Day, just like, let this day pass? When they have plenty of love in their lives that they could see if they weren't so busy beating themselves up for not having that love connection that we're supposed to all want. But even more maddening to me than that is the fact that that romantic, idyllic kind of Disney love, Hallmark card love, is the one and only love that we're given as the perfect option. What about the other kinds of love we feel? Love for the earth and its creatures. I hardly ever see my partner love more than when she runs into a puppy and there's like love everywhere. Love for certain ideals that we carry around in our hearts, like world peace or sustainability. love for those we care about deeply but don't have a romantic connection with, the love we have for our friends, the love we have for acquaintances, for neighbor, for stranger. When we limit the palette and expansiveness of our love to a tiny circle around us, we lose our ability to see just how loving we can be. We lose our capacity to know that we contain so much love. Walt Whitman had a wonderful poem that talked about a lot of things, about how he's full of contradictions and full of messiness. But one of the things that he said in that lovely Song of Myself poem is that he contains multitudes. And I like to think that we contain multitudes of love. But when we think it's only that romantic love that matters, we can't even see the rest of the love that we have. Now, during a recent sermon, my partner, Reverend Malora, who's sitting in the back probably cowering about my puppy reference, mentioned that the two of us, she said, we, your ministers, we love all of you. Now, I was seated at the back, kind of like she is today, and I couldn't see your faces. I was mostly seeing the back of your heads. But I was wondering if any of you rolled your eyes. If any of you were thinking, well, of course you do, because you have to, or because it's your job, an obligation that the two of you accepted when you became our ministers. Well, if you did roll your eyes a few weeks ago, I understand that reaction, but I want to challenge it anyway. I'll let Malora speak for herself. I found that's best. But speaking of love, yeah. But I love you not because I have to, not because I should, and not because I think it's the right thing to do. I love each and every one of you because I believe in you. I believe in your inherent goodness. It's our first principle, right? I believe in your desire to be loving and caring people. And I love you in your striving. I love you because it is a central part of my spiritual practice, part of my life to love as much as possible. My colleague in D.C. used to say what I said to the children this morning, which is that we come to church to learn how to love better. He said, when you boil all the platitudes and things we talk about in church down to its most basic essence, that's really why we come. We come to learn to love better, because we all need to learn to love better. We don't have it figured out. And I think what he meant by that, whenever he said that, I kind of scratched my head a little, but I think what he meant by that is we come to church and we learn to love better bit by encountering the people that we have chosen as a community. Our chosen community, not because everybody here is like me, not because everybody here will agree with me, not because these people are at all related to me, but because we share a common set of hopes, a common set of values, including a wild and hopeful love for humanity. This week, I was telling you that I was sharing with the kids that I got an email from my former boss at the preschool that I worked at, Woolsey Children's School in Berkeley, California. And I found out from her that two of the fathers of the preschoolers that I used to take care of have passed away since Christmas time, both of them of cancer. And I remembered this week all of my memories of these two gentlemen, of Bart and of Joe. Bart had a brain tumor which he was struggling with for about 12 years before he passed away this week. And Joe Mullen passed away 2 days before Christmas after struggling with pancreatic cancer. And I realized as I thought about those two men in particular and the wives and children that they left behind who I spent day after day caring for, I realized how much my life had been shaped by those families. I haven't seen them since I graduated from seminary in 1999. But it doesn't matter. I found as I read that email that the tears came down my cheeks and that my heart ached for these people because they had changed my life. They had been part of my circle of love. I bet all of you could look back over your life story and see those places where your heart has been, where pieces of you still are, where you have been shaped and formed by whom you have loved, by whom you still do. E.E. Cummings has that love poem where he says, "I carry you in my heart. I carry you in my heart." He's talking to his sweetheart. He says, "I'm never without you. Whatever I do is your doing, my dear." And I think, actually, that might be true of romantic love, but it's true of everybody. It's true of Bart and Joe. It's true of all those kids I took care of. I carry you in my heart. I am never without you. So how would we think of love if we thought in this broader sense? I think, friends, that we can learn a great deal from the ancient Greeks and even from the Hebrew scriptures as we try to expand our notions of love. In the Hebrew Bible, in the book of Leviticus, which has its problematic passages, yes, we also can see, however, that a notion of love was used by the kings of that time in treaties. Love for them at that time meant loyalty, meant looking out for one another's best interests and offering help in times of trouble. In this way, you could love a neighboring nation or tribe, and that love would draw forth from you as a leader and from your people a sense of connection that just might benefit and uphold the common good. Ancient Greeks even had four different words for love. These multiple words helped illuminate and clarify the many facets that love contains. Agape for them is the largest, broadest sense of love and includes God's love for humankind. It's an unconditional, all-encompassing kind of love. It's a vision of love that many justice movements have drawn upon, that Dr. King referenced a lot during the civil rights movement in the U.S. It's the type of love you can hold even for those, perhaps especially for those, with whom you are at odds. The second Greek notion of love is the one we're most familiar with. That's eros, romantic love, the aspect of love that we talk about all the time and yet are most confused about, perhaps. How does eros, this romantic sense of love, interact with the other ways we love? What do we miss when we fixate on love as romance or as lust and don't think about the agape kind of love? Or of the third type of Greek love, which is philia, a concept of love honed and developed by Aristotle over time, which is often seen as a slightly more removed or dispassionate kind of love, but includes the loyal type of love that one can feel for community, for friends, for family members. This is the love which I think we need to cultivate more of. Love and affection that is not rooted in romance, but rather in appreciation of a common or shared humanity. Finally, there's storge, which was new to me. I just found this out recently this week while I was researching this. This fourth aspect of love is most directly translated as affection and is seen as a sort of natural affection that bubbles up and flows, say, from parent to child, or from person to pet, or from person to natural world. It is a love that you don't have to work at. It is the only kind of love that is just sort of given to you. And the effort then in that type of love, the storg kind of love, is to continue to appreciate it for the gift that it is. I heard religion scholar Karen Armstrong in a speech talking about a practice that the Greeks had in 5th century BCE that I found very moving. As part of the festival of Dionysus, the god of transformation and wine, among other things, why wouldn't you not have a festival for Dionysus? There would be several days of performances and celebrations. The Greeks would gather by a stage while these productions were being put on, and at one point in the festival, each year, a tragedy would be performed on the stage. Festival goers were invited to witness this deep tragedy in the play, to see the suffering and the struggle on stage. And then at some point around the climax of the tragedy, the director would look to the audience and invite them to weep. The director would literally come out and say, "Okay, everybody, time to weep. Cry." The audience would cry together. And the purpose of this annual ritual, said Karen Armstrong, was to remind everyone of two things. One was that no matter what your lot in life, rich, poor, educated or not, old or young, sorrow befalls us all. We all, at one point or another, weep because of what life brings our way. And the second thing she said that this collective sorrow bearing brought up was that weeping can create a bond. That by weeping together every year, this community would feel more keenly their shared humanity and understand more keenly that we are all, quite literally, in this life together. Perhaps our notions of life and love would be more expansive if we gathered together once a year in Centennial Square to weep. Perhaps we would equate love with more than romance if we had more popular culture images of love that offered an expansive view. Maybe rather than just Valentine's Day every year, we should have Philia Day. At least one opportunity to regularly reflect on how well we are doing at including more people and more possibilities for love in our lives. It might not be as catchy, I admit. There aren't boxes of chocolate associated with it. There's no image of Cupid. But I think that we would find the practice a healthy challenge. It's my prayer for us, friends, that we might know that in our tears, in our heartbreak, in our ability to love once again, even after love has been broken or lost or frustrated, that we are more connected than perhaps we will ever know. Let us give thanks for love in all of its forms, this day and every day. Amen.